From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoen, wishing you a happy 4th of July. Today on the show, we look at America from three different perspectives. Richard Blanco, who was President Obama's inaugural poet, reads from his new book of poems, How to Love a Country, about the complexities of being an American. David Troyer is an Ojibwe anthropologist and writer, author of the new book, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee. It's about the often inaccurate depiction of Native Americans as long-suffering. He focuses on what he calls Indian life rather than Indian death. And finally, the story of Plessy v. Ferguson, the infamous Supreme Court decision in 1896 upholding racial segregation. Steve Luxenberg tells us about the people who fought on both sides of the law that remained on the books until 1954 and Brown versus the Board of Education. That's all ahead. First News. This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoen. We have a special show for you today on the 4th of July, Three Perspectives on America and American History. We begin with poet Richard Blanco, who says he was made in Cuba, assembled in Spain, and imported to the United States when he was a little boy. In 2013, he read a poem for President Obama's second swearing-in, the first Latino, the first immigrant, the first openly gay man, and the youngest of the inaugural poets. His new book of poems, How to Love a Country, is about the complexities of being an American and the experience of being the other. It's both personal and political. In this segment of the show, Blanco reads from his new book and discusses his life as a poet. I want to have you read Mother Country.
Sure.
And I should say to our listeners that this was one of the poems that you submitted to the Obama administration for the second inaugural. They did not choose it.
Right.
But I think there's so much in here, and especially, I think, related to the title of your book, How to Love a Country.
Yeah, and actually, you hit it right on the nose, Marty, because this is where the title serve began for the book. It evolved a little bit, but it comes from this. Yes, this was the third poem that they chose, and I just, as you'll see, I just wanted to the reader, myself and the reader, to put themselves in my mother's emotional shoes and her journey out of Cuba, to maybe think about how we can look at our own country through the eyes of an immigrant that sort of always reminds us of those ideals and holds those ideals up to the light because of these journeys that they risk their lives for and lose family and whatnot. Mother country, madre patria. To love a country as if you've lost one. 1967, my mother leaves Cuba for America, a scene I imagine as if standing in her place. One foot inside a plane destined for a country she knew only as a name, a color on a map, or glossy photos from drugstore magazines. Her other foot anchored to the platform of her patria, her hand clutched around one suitcase, taking only what she needs most, hand-colored photographs of her family, her wedding veil, the doorknob of her house, a jar of dirt from her backyard, goodbye letters she won't open for years. The sorrowful drone of engines, one last deep breath, a familiar air she'll take with her. One last glimpse at all she'd ever known. The palm trees wave goodbye as she steps onto the plane. The mountains shrink from her eyes as she lifts off into another life to love a country as if you've lost one. I hear her, once upon a time, reading picture books over my shoulder at bedtime, both of us learning English, sounding out words as strange as the talking animals and fair-haired princesses in their pages. I taste her first attempts at macaroni and cheese, but with chorizo and peppers, and her shame over Thanksgiving turkeys, always dry, but countered by her perfect pork pernil and garlic yuca. I smell the rain of those mornings, huddled as one under one umbrella, waiting for the bus to her 10-hour days at the cash register. And at night, the zzz, zzz of her sewing her own blouses and quinceañera dresses for her grown nieces still in Cuba, guessing at their sizes. And the gowns she'd sell to neighbors to save for a rusty white sedan, no hubcaps, no air conditioning, sweating all the way through our first vacation to Florida theme parks to love a country, as if you've lost one, as if it were you on a plane departing from America forever. clouds closing like curtains on your country, the last scene in which you're a madman scribbling the names of your favorite flowers, trees, and birds you'd never see again, your address and phone number you'd never use again, the color of your father's eyes and your mother's hair, terrified you could someday, somehow, forget these. To love a country. As if I was my mother last spring, hobbling, insisting I help her climb all the way up to the U.S. Capitol, as if she were here before you today instead of me, explaining her tears, her cheeks pink as the cherry blossoms coloring the air that day, when she stopped, turned to me, and said, "You know, mijo, it isn't where you're born that matters. It's where you choose to die. That's your country."
And that's our guest, Richard Blanco, reading from his new book of poetry, How to Love a Country, a poem titled Mother Country. And there's so much in there. There's sadness and loss and memories and grief, but also being in a country where her son is the inaugural poet.
Yeah, there's this great, you know, my mother has been my, in a weird way, my lifeline, in a weird way, but an ironic way, perhaps, my lifeline to Cuba, because she left, it's not in the poem, but her entire family behind, her parents, eight brothers and sisters, every living relative. But in a way, because of her quest for the American dream, she's also sort of my sort of guiding light and my sort of reminder of what that really means, right? All the sacrifices she made, all, in fact, you know, working those 10-hour days so I could have an education, insisting on go to college, et cetera, et cetera. All those decisions that she made and sacrificed eventually put me up on the podium in Washington in some way, right? In a way, that was a story that was begun by her journey. And just thinking about, you know, she always reminds me again of those ideas. And in that way, you know, I am optimistically patriotic always because of I see the color, the world, the our country through her eyes often.
It's interesting thinking about today where gay marriage is legal, but immigration is as fraught as ever.
Yeah, I think that's part of a lot of the a lot of what I take up in the new book of poetry and How to Love a Country, looking also at historical other kinds of immigration stories we're not as familiar with, like the Asian American or Chinese American immigration through Angel Island, and realizing that there's a historical that we have flip flopped on immigration in different ways and with different groups, and it's a complex issue. But I will say, as I've been saying at my readings, I've been hearing about especially the Mexico-U.S. problem, quote-unquote, since I was a kid. And I'm kind of – and I'm at this point thinking, really, there's no fair and equitable solution, compromise, something that can happen that can fix what is apparently a problem only to politicians, right? And also, given my Latin American background, there's more complexity to it than I think that even the news reports, right? It's not just the United States, and it's not just the Central Mexico and Central America, but really there's something more going on, and I think part of it is just geopolitical power grabs and things like that. Nobody wants poor, destitute people, right? And so I think that's part of what's happening, and I wish the news would report more on it. I'm looking at it through the lens of poetry, but I think there's more to it than meets the eye.
Well, it sounds like poets, if you're representing all poets in America, but if the poets are more optimistic, the journalists?
Yeah, and I think it's the human story. You know, I don't consider myself a political poet even in this book, but part of what I try to do is to put real names, faces, lives, and stories to these issues that get abstracted, to get skewed, and we lose sight of the human story. My mentor Campbell McGrath always said that part of being a poet is being an emotional historian.
You also write about, and I don't know if it's true for people in exile who are sort of forced to leave their country, or whether immigrants feel this more broadly, which is in the home country, nothing tastes as good as the mangoes,
right.
Or nothing is as beautiful as the sunset, or nothing is as whatever, which is interesting to think about loving a country, but also what you have left behind and how maybe things were better there.
With exiles, I think it's a shared experience, that sense of nostalgia, whether one is an immigrant or exile. In the exile, I think it's perhaps more exaggerated because there isn't necessarily always that they want to leave because of certain circumstances, but sometimes they just have to leave. Their lives are in danger. So, and there's always this idea that we're returning to that the country's going to change. So it gets more and more nostalgic over time. And it really is an interesting space because I'm growing up as such. On the one hand, they want you to be Americano.
Exactly.
They want you to be successful in this country, but then they're like, you're too Americano, right? So there's a fine line.
Did you ever find that fine line?
Yeah, I mean, even today, my mom, like, sort of, even after experiencing the inauguration, she kind of reminds me that I'm still from this little boy from Westchester, and I think it's hard for her to grasp that immensity of which, of course, she dreamed for me, right? In some ways, right, without even knowing. So I still have to come back to center a lot. But yeah, it's really an interesting space to negotiate.
I'd love to have you read, it's called Como Tu, or Like You, Like Me, and this is another poem from your new collection.
Yeah, and this is actually relates to what you were talking about. So I arrived at 45 days old from Spain in my mother's arms, and so I had no choice in coming to this country. And when all this DACA and the Dreamers thing was, I still don't know where that even lies today, right? The repeal and then not the repeal and the deal and whatnot. I was putting myself in the shoes and suddenly feeling, wow, I came as a documented immigrant. But in some ways, I know Cuba culturally, but I couldn't imagine just going back to Cuba to live because it's not really my country. So it's a cultural attachment, but there's nothing beyond that. It's its own place. So this is a poem of camaraderie and sort of compassion and cheerleading and championing the emotions that I must feel, the dreamers must feel. And there's a little epigraph by the Salvadoranian poet Roque Dalton, which I'll read first.
Sure.
Mis venas no terminan en mí, sino en la sangre unánime de los que luchan por la vida. My veins don't end in me, but in the unanimous blood of those who struggle for life. Como tú, like you, like me. Como tú, I question history's blur in my eyes each time I face a mirror. Like a mirror, I gaze into my palm, a wrinkled map I can't read, my lifeline, an unmade road I can't find, can't trace back to the fork in my parents' track that cradled me here. Como tú, I woke up to this dream of a country I didn't choose, that didn't choose me, trapped in the nightmare of its hateful glares. Como tú, I'm also from the lakes and farms, waterfalls and prairies of another country I can't fully claim either. Como tú, I'm either a mirage living among these faces and streets that raised me here, or I'm nothing, a memory, forgotten by all I was taken from and can't return to again. Like memory, at times I wish I could erase the music of my name in Spanish. At times I cherish it and despise my other syllables clashing in English. Como tú, I want to speak of myself in two languages at once. Despite my two tongues, no word defines me. Like words, I read my footprints like my past, erased by waves of circumstance. My future uncertain as wind, like the wind. Como tú, I carry songs, howls, whispers, thunders growl. Like thunder, I'm a foreign-born cloud that's drifted here. I'm lightning and the balm of rain. Como tú, our blood rains for the dirty thirst of this land. Like thirst, like hunger, we ache with the need to save ourselves and our country from itself.
That was poet Richard Blanco. His new book of poems is How to Love a Country. Coming up next on Radio Times, Ojibwe writer and anthropologist David Troyer on the resilience of Native Americans. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. I'm Marty Moscowen, and this is Radio Times here on WHYY. We hope you are enjoying your 4th of July. We're featuring interviews from the archives today about being an American. David Troyer is an Ojibwe anthropologist and writer who wants to correct the perception of Native Americans as tragic and long-suffering. He says that depiction misses the important story about surviving and thriving in spite of tragedy and loss, betrayal, and dislocation. His new book is The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, and he joins us to talk about growing up on the reservation, his connection to Ojibwe traditions, and the rising power and prominence of American Indians. I'd love to have you read from the very beginning of your book, because I think it kind of sets the stage for the book and for our conversation.
Sure. This is from, as you say, early on, page 11. This book is a counter-narrative to the history that has been told about us, but it is something more as well. It is an attempt to confront the ways we Indians ourselves understand our place in the world, our self-regard, the vision and versions we hold of who we are and what we mean matters greatly. We carry within us stories of our origins and ideas about our families, our clans, and our communities. Sadly, these narratives do not always or even mostly stand in opposition to the ways in which we are read by outsiders. We often, too often, agree with accounts of our own demise. For many years, too many years, I understood my reservation, Leech Lake Reservation in northern Minnesota, only as a place of abject suffering, a nowhere place where nothing happened and good ideas went to die. I saw it as in America, but not of America. I saw myself and my tribe as a ruined people whose greatness lay behind us.
Describe Leech Lake where you grew up. Well, as a kid, where you grew up.
Well, my understandings have evolved over time, and those understandings I just relayed in that passage were the ways in which I thought of that place as a kid. And as a kid—
Because you believe that narrative as well?
Sure. I think I, and I can't speak for other Native people, but I think other Native people as well, have borrowed the same understanding that informs Dee Brown's book as our own understanding. It's, you know, we're as susceptible to the virus of influence as anyone else. And the fact is that the dominant narrative that is used to describe Indian lives is a tragic narrative. That's the only storytelling mode that is really used to think about Native folk. And that's the narrative I inherited, and that's the narrative I used, you know, to frame my understanding of the world. And it was only after I left Leech Lake and I came out to New Jersey for college, it was only when I was separated from home and my family and my tribe that I was finally able to see it as a place not just of suffering, to see my reservation not merely as a basin of pain, but as a place that was interesting and vibrant and complicated.
Well, you even write on the next page that even looking at your own family, and we should talk about your parents because that's an extraordinary story, but there was death and murder and, you know, things that are tragic no matter where you come from.
Right. And part of the problem was that, yes, there are difficult things with which Native people have to contend, as you mentioned, even in my own family. Mm-hmm. But that those aren't the only things. But those were the only things I could see for a while.
Right. As you said, once you left the reservation and kind of looking back on it, you saw it differently. And now you've got a couple of kids, and what is their relationship to the reservation? You live there part-time during the year.
Yeah, part-time during the year. My children are Ojibwe on my side and Seneca on their mom's side, and so they have two tribal communities to which they belong and two tribal communities in which they feel really, really comfortable. And for them, going back to Leech Lake feels like a homecoming.
Yeah.
That to them is home in a really fundamental way. They seem very unconflicted about the kind of back and forth travel that really defines not just their lives, but the lives of a lot of Native people. But after I left, I was determined to return.
Mm-hmm.
I went to grad school in Michigan and then dropped out and moved back to the reservation, lived there for a number of years, and then ever since then have been trying to find some way to balance my need to root myself there and a way to balance my need to flow out with the current around the country and to be in the mix.
Well, in fact, you talk about the sort of urbanized Indian, I'm not sure if that's the correct kind of language or not, but the fact that certainly after World War II, there was a lot of migration to cities and things, you know, people sort of creating their own communities within communities outside of the reservation.
Right. People are fond of noting that the majority of Native Americans live in cities now rather than on reservations, but that's not entirely true. The majority of Native people don't live on reservations, but most of us live in small urban areas, small towns and suburbs, as well as inner cities. But the majority of Indians live in towns like Harlem, Montana, and Bemidji, Minnesota, and Walker, Minnesota, places like that. And so there have been many diasporas. But that's one of the points of the book, is that you can't really understand American Indian history outside of American history. The migration of American Indian people from reservation communities to rural, suburban, and urban areas starting in the 40s and 50s can't be understood separate from the great migration of African Americans, for example, from the rural South to the urban North. It was part of a similar nationwide movement.
You write a lot about, and I was really very taken with the section about the Native American or the Indian boarding schools that were created. I guess the first one, maybe the most infamous one, I'm not sure, was in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. And I was wondering if you could read something that Richard Henry Pratt, I guess he was the founder of the school, what he wrote about the students that he thought he would be educating there.
Sure. It's difficult a little emotionally to read
course.
Pratt's words, but they're worth remembering, just to remember what we've had to fight against. He writes, "A great general has said that the only good Indian is a dead one, and that high sanction of his destruction has been an enormous factor in promoting Indian massacres. In a sense, I agree with the sentiment, but only in this, that all the Indian there is in the race should be dead, kill the Indian in him, and save the man. Theorizing citizenship into people is a slow operation. What a farce it would be to attempt teaching American citizenship to the Negroes of Africa. They could not understand it, and if they did, in the midst of such contrary influences, they could never use it. Neither can the Indians understand or use American citizenship theoretically taught to them on Indian reservations. They must get into the swim of American citizenship. They must feel the touch of it day after day until they become saturated with the spirit of it and thus become equal to it."
It's horrifying language.
It is.
It's horrifying.
It is.
But that was the dominant perception and I guess policy at that time, which is to get the children away from their parents and Americanize them.
Right. The federal government wanted to get out of the Indian business. It wanted to be rid of what it considered the, quote, Indian problem, end quote. The best way to destroy tribes was to destroy Native families. And the best way to destroy them was to break the intergenerational transfer of knowledge and understanding and connection. And so it was, in fact, federal policy to remove Indian children from their homes.
Forcibly.
Forcibly in many instances, coercively in most instances. And in some few instances, Native people had no better options. Right. And willingly and gladly saw learning English and trades and things like that these things that were studied in these schools as a viable future. Mm-hmm. So that shouldn't be forgotten either. Some Native people were all for it. Not many, but some. Right. And so many generations, these schools lasted from the late 1880s up through the 1930s and a few into the 1940s.
Wow.
A couple generations of Native children were sent to these schools. But this is the thing that I think is so fascinating, that it would be easy, going back to this idea of tragedy versus complexity, it would be easy to only understand the history of residential boarding schools as an unmitigated tragedy. And certainly it was traumatic.
Because they couldn't speak their native language. They had to wear uniforms. All the attempts to erase that culture and
identity. They were forcibly converted to Christianity. forced to speak English, forbidden from speaking their native languages, couldn't practice their native religions. All those things were true and traumatic for native kids at these schools. On the other hand, you took all these native kids from all these tribes scattered across the country, tribes that were unknown to one another, tribes that perhaps had been traditional enemies of one another, and you put them in these schools, and these kids had to rely on one another. And they suffered the same injustices. They had the same experiences. And they built networks. They had friendships. They had romantic relationships. They got to know one another and learn from one another so that when they left those schools and they went back to their tribes and they started working in tribal government or maybe for the federal government or maybe joined the army, maybe learned a trade and was a heavy equipment operator, whatever it might have been, they had a network of other native people on whom they could rely. So on one hand, these schools were designed to destroy tribes. On the other, in many ways, they helped Indians advance into the middle part of the 20th century by creating networks of support.
That's such a fascinating but important thing to understand about the sort of resilience in the face of attempts to essentially take away your identity, take away your culture, that people are, as you say, complicated. You also write, David, that a third of Native adult males served and fought in World War II. Now, I think we know about, the code breakers and
code talkers.
But a third of him, I mean, I just think this is a piece of history we need to understand better.
Right. People always ask, why did Native people volunteer to serve at such a rate? And there's no one answer. There are many answers which overlap. For a lot of Native men, it was the best job you could get, that because the only other jobs open to you were seasonal or manual labor, day labor. So economics were a big motivator. There are cultural reasons why joining the armed forces were really important. There were certain ceremonial positions in different Native societies that you couldn't hold unless you were a combat veteran. So that's another reason for some people. And another reason which people have a hard time understanding was that they saw themselves as Native and they saw themselves as American, and they were and are deeply patriotic. And that's probably more like my grandfather, who served in the 2nd Infantry Division and served at Normandy and was wounded in the Battle of the Bulge. And he was very proud to have served America as well as represented our tribe.
As I said, this book covers a lot of history, and a lot of that history includes pogroms and relocations and, as we mentioned, the boarding schools, the Trail of Tears and disenfranchisement that goes on and on and on. There's also something called the Dawes Act, and this is if you can just help us understand what that meant for Native people.
Right. I should also step out and address a possible concern that listeners might have, which is that I wasn't really interested in writing a laundry list of abuse.
No, I get it. Yeah. Yes. And I apologize if it sounds
right.
Right. Yes.
And I was trying to show the complex nature of contemporary Native life. And part of that is hardship, but part of that is the creativity that we've applied to our own lives, right?
Sure.
And the Dawes Act is no exception. The United States government has tried again and again and again to do us in, either outright or through policy. And again and again and again, we've resisted and we've succeeded in not just surviving, but in thriving. So the Dawes Act was to sort of our relationship with the land that boarding schools were to ourselves. So the government wanted to get out of the Indian business. It wanted to be done with us. And so it thought we should break up reservations, which are holding us back from joining the mainstream. And so the Dawes Act basically broke up tribal community property and allotted small parcels to Native individuals as a means to encourage private ownership, which was the most American thing of all.
Of course.
And it succeeded in radically reducing our land base. It succeeded in fracturing us in many ways. But in many ways, we learned to adapt. There was a diaspora at that time that, if this is what's going to happen here, I'm just going to homestead like an American. And my land can't be taken from me. And so people made that work for them, homesteading. out in Kansas and Nebraska and things like that. So
you're still here.
Still here. Right.
In spite of everything.
In spite of everything.
Let me quote something Richard Nixon said, and this was in 1970, and I'll just quote he says, the story of the Indian in America is something more than the record of a record of the white man's frequent aggression, broken agreements, intermittent remorse, and prolonged failure. It is a record of endurance, of survival, of adaptation and creativity in the face of overwhelming obstacles. It's a record of enormous contributions to this country, its art, its culture, and he goes on from there. And I think people would be surprised to know that Richard Nixon talked that way.
I think they would
be. Or felt that way.
And maybe Nixon, just like Native people, you know, shouldn't necessarily be completely understood in relation to the darkest parts of his legacy. Because the fact is, he was arguably the best president for Native people in the last 50 years.
So interesting.
And he believed and he ushered in a new era of federal Indian policy, which has really been the policy ever since his term and a half, whatever, which was the era of tribal self-determination. Not unlike my father, Nixon believed that Native people, the Native tribes, were gifted, intelligent people who understood what was best for them, and that the government should honor its obligations, but it should quit with its paternalistic attitude and listen to Native people as they told the government what would work best for them. And so for that, I mean, Nixon deserves a lot of praise.
Yeah.
He really does.
Yeah. So what is the American Indian dream? I mean, we talk about the American dream. What is the American Indian dream?
I don't know. I mean, the American dream is to sort of work hard and get ahead and do better than your parents. And of course, that dream has troubled our sleep for a long time.
Right.
You know, people like Fitzgerald point that out to us, that we've had troubled sleep for some while. The American Indian dream, I riff on this in the book a little bit, but I think it's different. It's that, too. We want to succeed. We want to move ahead. We're an ancient and modern people. That's important to remember. But I think also the American Indian dream is not just a reaching ahead, but it's also a reaching back. And we understand ourselves to be members of ancient cultures, and that is an understanding that informs how we view ourselves as individuals, how we view ourselves as members of tribes, families, clans, and how we view ourselves as Americans. Our relationship to history is different, not just because our history is troubled, but because I think of our unique understandings. Of course, this is different from tribe to tribe.
Sure.
Every tribe is different. But I do think it's something one can say about Native people generally, that we dream a slightly different dream. And that works for us.
Yeah. David Troyer is an Ojibwe anthropologist and writer. His new book is The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee. Up next, after this very short break, the story of Plessy v. Ferguson, the infamous Supreme Court decision that made segregation legal. Stay with us. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We close things out today with the story behind Plessy v. Ferguson. That's the 1896 Supreme Court decision that made segregation legal. It involved Homer Plessy, a light-skinned black man who was arrested riding in a first-class car on a train, which was against the law in Louisiana. His case made it all the way to the highest court, and the decision that bears his name led to Jim Crow laws. Segregated housing, bathrooms, water fountains, lines of credit, employment, travel until 1954, and Brown versus the Board of Education. Steve Luxenberg tells this important story in his new book, Separate. I learned a lot reading this book. One, that you say that Jim Crow laws that basically defined what blacks could do in the South really had its roots in the North. Explain that apparent discrepancy.
Well, you know, we think of the South because the South is where separation spread in the 20th century. Notice I use the word separation.
Yes.
Because in the 19th, they didn't use the word segregation. If you look at newspapers, that's what the word was. But In the South, before the Civil War, there was slavery. You're not separating the enslaved population from the masters, putting them on a – they didn't have many railroad cars in the South anyway because they were lagging behind in construction. So the first separate railroads are in Massachusetts. In 1838, in near Boston, these lines are – there are eight railroads. Three of them are running separate cars. Only three. So it's already a division.
Right.
Right. We're not having
– And we're talking about freed blacks in the North.
Right. Obviously. So you might think, well, there may be a lot of black passengers. And you would be wrong. The population of Massachusetts in 1840, 1% of the population were people of color. There weren't a lot of black passengers. You didn't need separate cars. In fact, many of them ran empty. But the first, the Eastern Railroad opens up in 1838. And on the first run, there's a newspaper article a month later that refers to two drunken white sailors who are behaving so badly and disgusting the other passengers that they are banished to the refuse as in trash,
right,
or Jim Crow car. And when I ran across this in my digital digging, I was astonished because I think of Jim Crow as a term that comes in the late 19th century.
Right.
But it was used as almost a second reference, as if the crew and the readers would know exactly what was being talked about.
And these cars were also called dirt cars.
Dirt cars.
Forgotten barbarians. And these were the cars where the few blacks in the North were forced to sit as they traveled by train.
Yes, and we have to think about the dawn of the railroad age. This is like a cell phone to us. This is new technology. There's nothing like a railroad car to throw together a mass of humanity.
Sure.
No, a stagecoach doesn't do it. It's too small. And people have to ask the question of themselves, where do I sit? And some railroad companies thought their white passengers, they weren't too concerned about their black passengers, would want to sit only with white people.
Well, let's fast forward even past the Civil War and to the South and actually to New Orleans, Louisiana. Louisiana had this law basically segregating its railroad cars.
Huge difference. In 1838, we have a company policy. No law. Right. Not required. Fast forward to 1890. And Louisiana is not the first state to enact a separate car, that's not a motor car, that's a rail car, separate car statute. They were preceded by first Florida, then Mississippi, but those statutes were all slightly different. And what this statute in Louisiana did in 1890, which the committee that actually brings this case of mixed race, French-speaking Creoles, Creole being the word for native-born,
right.
What they have protested this law at the legislature. They went to lobby just like people lobby today. They didn't succeed, and they decide they're going to bring a test case. But what the legislature said, this is in the preamble, is that trains running in the state must have separate, equal but separate cars. Equal but separate
cars.
Cars for white and colored passengers, not separate but equal cars. It just happens to be a little different phraseology.
Louisiana passes a separate car act. Then a committee, I love this name, the Citizens Committee to Test the Constitutionality of the Separate Car Law is organized. There's a guy named Martinet who's involved in this. And eventually there's a young man named Homer Plessy, who's really the person who defies the law. What do we need to know about him? And I know he was light-skinned. Was that sort of his main reason that they chose him?
It was probably the only reason they
really?
Chose
him. Really? I was wondering whether he had any civil rights activism that he had done.
He was definitely part of that group and their political activism. But he was young. He was 29 years old. You know, the name of the committee, I laughed when I looked at it. It was on their letterhead. And I thought, well, no PR agency helped them with a logo here.
It's a mouthful. It works. It is. But I like it.
It's straightforward. But Plessy was the second of two test cases. And the first one, which we won't go into in any detail, happened. And it didn't quite work out the way they wanted it. They actually sort of won, but it left in place separation on the railroad in Louisiana. It did not leave it in place on railroads running from other parts of the country through Louisiana. And so they needed another volunteer. And the thinking of the legal team, now these are three white lawyers working with Louis Martinet, the mixed race head of the engine of the committee. He wasn't technically the head of it. And they decided that it would benefit their argument if they could get someone who could cause confusion, as I write. He was fair-skinned enough to cause confusion. And they wanted to argue that how the heck is a conductor walking down the aisle of a train supposed to separate his passengers when there's a whole group of them that don't – you can't tell the race unless you ask them.
Right.
And they wanted to say, well, he can't ask them because he's not a jury. He can't take testimony. He can't have due process. And so the law should be thrown out as unconstitutional under the 14th Amendment, which required that due process. And they had a very contorted legal argument, a wonderfully complex legal argument for how your race is your reputation and you shouldn't be deprived of it without due process.
Oh, that's fascinating. And Plessy, I mean, he defies the law on this train. What happens to him after this and even after this decision, which we will get to? But
well, the committee issued a report in 1897 after it was all over, sort of holding themselves accountable to the public. And they make clear that they don't want the first volunteer or Plessy to spend any time in jail. They were very happy to not have to pursue what's called the habeas corpus route. But they find a way, with the help of Judge Ferguson, who rules that the act in Louisiana is constitutional. But with his help, they make it a case that hinges on an error of Judge Ferguson. So that's why it goes to the court as Plessy versus Ferguson. They're suing Ferguson for making an error. And so they get to the court, which isn't easy to do.
No.
And the strategy is brilliant. And then they throw about a kitchen sink worth of arguments against the court. And the court is overwhelmed by them and ignores most of them.
So this case then makes its way to the U.S. Supreme Court. What are the arguments that come from Plessy's lawyer?
Well, all the arguments are based in the 13th and 14th Amendments. And those amendments very quickly are the one that abolishes slavery and says that no one should be in involuntary servitude. That's the 13th. The 14th is the equal protection of under the laws and citizenship rights for blacks and due process. Their job, every lawyer's job, one, is to win. So they want to choose arguments that they think might persuade the court. They look at this court and they say, a lot of white men, all white men, mm-hmm. obviously, in the mm-hmm. 19th century, men of property, men of privilege, men of wealth. Let's make a property right argument. But they need to base it in something, and they base it in the 13th and 14th Amendment, and that's what I mentioned before about race is your property, and you shouldn't be able to have it taken away. I mean, if Plessy can pass for white, why would you not let him do that?
Sure, sure.
Now, it's not a very good argument, because if they had accepted it, what would we have? We'd have one car of white and mixed race passengers and one car of black passengers. So in my view, separation would have survived. So you might have asked, well, Turgay, are you really making a very good argument here?
Mm-hmm.
But he wanted the court to look again and look differently at the 14th Amendment, which the court had already said in previous civil rights cases they were not going to view expansively. So they lose because they can't get the court to accept the 13th and 14th Amendments.
Well, Justice Henry Billings Brown, he writes the Plessy decision, and several things he says. Separation doesn't stamp the colored race with a badge of inferiority. He was trying to say, essentially trying to say separate was equal, when, of course, we know that was not the case.
Well, and those words don't even appear in his decision.
Exactly.
Later on, the court uses them in Brown, and that's why we use them today. But Billings Brown is a fascinating character to me because he comes from this abolitionist neck of Western Massachusetts. You would have thought he would have ended up as a dissenter, or at least he would have been a candidate for dissent. But no, he writes the decision. In fact, of the seven justices, it was 7-1. One justice didn't participate. Of those seven justices, six are from Northern families.
Yeah.
So it's very much a case where the North is, I think, exhausted by the race question, and they're kind of washing their hands of what's happening in the South.
And didn't want the kind of commingling? I mean, they had these separate train cars in Massachusetts.
Exactly.
Right?
We can't know. There wasn't a poll taken of the justices to know which of them felt that whites were superior to blacks. I suspect all of them felt that way. Now, Harlan felt that way. He says so in his dissent, but he also says that makes no difference. Our Constitution is colorblind, a phrase he picked up from Turgay's brief, and there is no recognition of color when it comes to rights.
He does talk about the Constitution being colorblind. In law, there can be no superior dominant ruling class of citizens, no caste system here. I mean, it's a very strong opinion, and a lone one, we should say. I'm curious about what the response back in 1896 to this law was when it was passed.
Very little. And the reason is that the newspapers and the public have become used to the civil rights decisions of the Supreme Court starting in 1883. Harlan was the only dissenter in the 1883 civil rights cases. It doesn't have a name like Plessy versus Ferguson because there were five cases consolidated. He had partly created a momentum for its publication because he wasn't finished with it when the court announced his decision. Well, what they did in this case, in the civil rights cases, was overturn, declare unconstitutional, the Civil Rights Act of 1875, which is just like the Civil Rights Act of 1964. I mean, the radical Republicans in Congress, to use a term familiar today, were woke. They got it. They knew that they needed to not just have these amendments. They needed legislation to implement them, and they put that in the last clause of the 14th Amendment is Congress shall have the right to enact legislation.
Oh, interesting.
So they covered themselves with the Supreme Court. Well, it didn't work. Supreme Court said this law is too expansive. It applies beyond states to individuals and companies. We're not buying it. Well, Harlan dissented in a very ringing dissent. His dissent in Plessy was published nowhere.
Wow.
Not because they weren't interested. And newspapers in those days, now remember, this is not a Supreme Court press corps standing outside with Twitter and Instagram. They can't transmit the news immediately. And they see this case as maybe worth a third paragraph. Some newspapers put it in the headline. My newspaper did, thank God. But most newspapers didn't. And it took several decades, several more Supreme Court decisions citing Plessy as a precedent for it to be recognized that this was really where separate but equal began.
And does it lead then to just the myriad ways that segregation was applied to housing and schools and water fountains and bathrooms and sitting in the back of the bus?
I say, it's hard to understand because it didn't – I have Google alerts. I get Plessy-related articles. They come and they say things like the Supreme Court established the doctrine of separate but equal and made it the law of the land in the Plessy case. They did no such thing. Now, that's the effect of Plessy. Right. It's not wrong to say that, but they didn't do it. And I don't like reading that because I feel like it takes the rest of the country off the hook. Oh, until the Supreme Court established something, there was no separate but equal. But in fact, there had been separation for decades. The Supreme Court are followers, not leaders. They are sanctioning what the country had permitted.
You mentioned this earlier, that there's nothing more sort of basic than transportation. You know, if you get on a bus, you're going to share it with people. If you get on a train, you're going to share it with people. And thinking about this Plessy case and that it had to do with segregated train cars, thinking of the Green Book, that blacks in the South, they had a Green Book so they knew where it would be safe to have a motel room or to spend the night or where they could have dinner, thinking obviously Rosa Parks, deciding I am not going to sit in the back of the bus. But something about the sort of basicness of transportation makes it important.
We can't go anywhere without transportation.
Well, exactly.
We can't stay anywhere. So these basic – but, you asked – Plessy opened the door. I think that's a better way to think about it. To every other state in the South to enact its own legislation. It opened the door to companies and institutions enacting policies that would separate people. Separate waiting rooms, separate bathrooms, separate water fountains. Those indelible images that we see, those black and white images, colored white. These are the images that partly drove me to write this book. I mean, when I was in my career as a journalist, I have so often edited and written stories about race. And yet, when I was looking around for a new book topic, I didn't feel I really understood it. And I felt like I needed to understand the roots of racial separation so that I could understand today's arguments over race. Because this case, I think, reverberates down through. If you look at statistics of the gap between white and black wealth, mm-hmm. white and black housing patterns, white and black education, there's still a huge gap.
And you think Plessy helps us understand
I think
that?
Plessy helped create it.
Create it.
It's very difficult to catch up. I mean, President Johnson, when he gave a speech about the Voting Rights Act of 1965, he talked about a starting line. But, you can remove the shackles of slavery, but you don't necessarily – you can't end all of the oppression that has happened beforehand. It has made you start way back from the starting line. So I feel like we do need to understand that this is a compelling story, I feel, that needs to be told today. And, you know, it reminds us that racial progress in America is never comes swiftly or easily.
No. Or a straight line or anything related to that.
And straight lines in transportation or in race.
That was Steve Luxenberg, author of Separate, The Story of Plessy v. Ferguson and America's Journey from Slavery to Segregation. And that's Radio Times today. We always want to know what you think about the show. Send us an email, whyy.org/radiotimes. Happy 4th of July from the Radio Times team, producers Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thanks for listening.